to introduce our next speaker, Joey.
I'm Joey, I'm down the hall. My sobriety date is December 13, 2010. My sponsor is Suzanne Newman. And my home groups are the Tuesday Lion's Den and the Sunday Pyramid in Orchid. And the first thing I'd like to do is take a little group conscience. How many people just think Sarah should get back up here and continue? I can't tell you what it was like the way it really happened. I can only tell you what it was like the way I remember it. One of the things I've learned since I came into Alcoholics Anonymous is that my memories and my perception were sometimes very skewed. When my first sponsor asked me what my childhood was like, I told her I was physically and emotionally abused. It was constant criticism at home. My parents were overprotective. I couldn't do anything. And this list of woes that painted me as the victim. And then when I did my first fourth step, I put down, I had a resentment with this girl that I was with on this horseback riding trip in Wyoming. And I had a resentment with the leader of the Girl Scout troop I was part of. And I had a resentment with someone at the gymnastics club I was part of. And I started thinking, you know, for somebody who was just criticized and never allowed to do anything, I sure did a lot of things. And that's when those memories started to come back. One of the things that was hard for me initially was believing that I had a part in anything. I was the victim. My parents were responsible for everything. What could I possibly have an amends for? And when I was 14 years old, I was in the hospital, and the doctor told my parents that my liver had a 50% chance of healing itself. And I remember their faces, and I believed at that time that my alcoholism only affected me. And my first sponsor helped me see that that other people were really affected too, and that I got some amends to make. My first drink was when I was about 6 years old. I don't remember my parents drinking, I don't think they did. But they had a lot of liquor in the bottom cabinet, and they still live in the house today that I lived in then, and I still picture that liquor in that cabinet, even though it's probably but my sister got it out, and we used to like to have coffee when we were adults to pretend we were grown ups. And she poured this dark liquid into the coffee, and I don't know what it was, but it gave me that warm, glowing feeling, and I really liked it. I don't know if my parents ever found out about that, but they got rid of the liquor at some point. My next drink was on a camp house. A lady in our study group gave me a drink of beer, and I did not like it. I remember thinking, this doesn't feel good. I don't have that instant warm feeling that I had from that dark brown stuff, you know? And so, just a little bit. Does anybody remember Klein bottle?
Yes.
Okay, then I don't have to explain what it is. I was an alcoholic treatment residential facility. So as a young teenager, I was invited to Klein bottle. And in there, we attended meetings down in this garage down behind the house, and I couldn't drink. And I had been drinking and experiencing the freedom I felt from it at that point. And without having that drink, I was so uncomfortable in my own skin that I had to find something else to make me feel better. And for me, it was music. I would put headphones on with this really hard metal, and I would turn the volume all the way up. I'd crawl underneath the bed, and I'd lay there in this fetal position just listening to the music so that I didn't have to be present. And when they figured out that this probably wasn't helping, they took away my music. And so then I had to find something else, and I started cutting on myself, like so many of us do, and that brought temporary relief. Only problem is, after that, I got invited to this counseling session upstairs, and they told me they were going to put me in an adolescent psychiatric hospital. Back then, they took cutting a lot more seriously than they do today, and I remember one thing about that counseling session. I remember thinking, I don't care what you do with me, as long as I can get out of here and get a drink first. And I tried to jump out that second story with a wine bottle, and they had to literally sit on me to keep me in that room. And that was all I could think about. I'll go, fine, you just need a drink first. So, I did not believe I was alcoholic at that age, even though I was attending meetings and learned a little bit about it. I still don't. I think I was probably a potential alcoholic at that point. A little bit later, I was invited to juvenile hall, and I was there for a couple of days, and it was the scariest, most miserable 2 days of my life. I swore I was never going to go back. When I got out, they put me on home supervision, which meant that your parents, you know, if you didn't follow your rules, you went back to juvenile hall, essentially. And one of my rules was that I had to be home by 8 o'clock. So I was out drinking at Great Scott's Pizza in the mall, and it was coming up on 8 o'clock. And I remember thinking, should I go home drunk or miss my curfew? And not drinking was not an option. That just wasn't one of the choices. So I decided to go home on time, even though I was rather intoxicated. And my parents called the police, and I went back to juvenile hall. This time I stayed a little longer. And something, I had a totally different experience there. After I got past that first couple of days of discomfort, I realized that I didn't have to worry about food. I didn't have to worry about what to wear. I didn't have to worry about, you know, any social issues, and I got really comfortable being in there. And when it was time to go, I didn't want to leave. I wanted to stay. Life was really simple in there, and it was really complex out here. So I did get out, and my drinking progressed. And the first time I really tried to stop, I decided that I was only going to drink when I went out to a nice dinner, because that was a really appropriate way to drink. Have a glass of wine on a date, nice dinner, this was okay. So within a couple weeks of making that decision, I was taking myself out with regularity to a really nice restaurant overlooking the beach, and I'd order a little salad and about 6 glasses of wine, and I even bought myself a rose one time. But that didn't go so well. And, you know, the speaker that I heard most recently talked about, we as alcoholics, when we put our minds to something, we can do great things. And I went through a real period of depression when I lived in Oceano. And I woke up one morning and I decided, that's it. I'm getting a job today. I've been on disability and I didn't need to be. So I got up and I got a job, and my resume was exaggerated just a little bit. And I got the job, and then they came to me and they said, you know, we were looking at your resume and we think you'd be better suited for this director position up in Morro Bay. How much do you want? And so I took this job, big ego, big head, and I was doing the hiring and the firing and I mean, I was the director of an Alzheimer's unit, and I thought I had arrived. And within a very short time, I was coping with that stress by drinking. And I want to say that job lasted 3 months until my drinking had taken me to where I was sneaking out in the middle of the night and just hoping they didn't find me, you know. I had hired one of my drinking buddies so we could, you know, hang out and drink on the job, and I was not a good employee. So during that time in Morro Bay, for any of you who know me, I I love my poodle. I have a poodle. I've always had a brown poodle. I have a different one now. And I'm one of those really annoying dog people who takes their dog everywhere with them and treats it like a child. And when I was in Morro Bay, I put him in a crate, one of those big metal crates. And I went to the liquor store to get a bottle of wine. And I came back 4 days later. I hadn't left him any water. You know, I was just going to run to the liquor store. And that's the kind of thing that made me see my first step, my powerlessness, because everything that was important to me, all the values that I had, they were nothing once I started to drink. So I had a bottom there. I had what I considered a bottom there, and I was done. I was really done. My just drink wine at dinners turned into just drink wine, period, because that's not as bad as what I had been doing. And I remodeled my pantry to be nothing but wine racks, and I filled it all and became a connoisseur, right? I was just trying all these different things. And I found the one I liked, and I filled the cabinet all with this, you know, and I'd go through. It was insane. And I had rented a room to a young woman with a child who worked for me. And this girl was pregnant. She had a three-year-old, needed a little quiet, needed a responsible person around, a nice place to live. And I brought a party home every night. And that's something that it was really hard for me to make amends for, because I really loved her. I really loved her daughter. And that was another one of those examples where the relationships and friendships that I value become non-existent when I start to drink. So I came home to Santa Maria, and I came to AA. I didn't work the steps. I stayed around here, and I didn't drink for 4 or 5 years. And I was not going to meetings for the last 3 years of that. And one day I was at a birthday luncheon for a coworker. And you know, that's a really appropriate place to have a drink. Right? It's a very normal thing. I hadn't drank in a long time. I was married at the time. I had a successful job. And I decided that this was behind me now and I could have a drink. Within 3 months of that drink, I had lost my job, I was divorced, life was lower than it had ever been, and I saw the progression of my alcoholism. That very first day that I took that drink, I thought, wow, that went really well. I did this, I can do this. And I kept excusing myself to go to the restroom, and I'd run over to the bar. This was at the Olive Garden, and I'd run around the corner to the bar and have a shot and go back to the table. Yeah, this is great. So I go back. Well, and then I became obsessed with, when am I going to drink again? How am I going to bring this back into my life? So I went with the coworker, the one whose birthday it was, to her house that night, and she got out a bottle of tequila. So I was going to be very careful because I knew my risks with alcoholism. So I took a shot and I walked that tile line in the kitchen. And I made it. I could walk that line, so I took another one. And then I walked that line, and I took another one. Somehow I had forgotten that it takes a little while for it to kick in. I blacked out that night. I woke up the next morning, in bed with both of them, big knot and bruise on the top of my head from what I was later told was slipping in the shower where I had just gotten sick. You know, it was really, really classy stuff. And that was the very first night that I took that drink. And it only got worse from there. It was a long time before I was able to come back in. I got a second chance at one point. I had gone up on disability to keep from getting fired because I could not drink at work. And coworkers would look for me and they'd find me on the bathroom floor just loving that feeling of the cold tile on my face. And so I ran out on disability with a stress or mental health type thing so that I didn't get fired. And that company, about a year later after me being on disability, offered me another job. and I was going to do this. I was going to be responsible. This was a great, great opportunity. And the first thing I did was I went to the bar to celebrate. So that began about 6 months of, you know, drinking on another job. You know, I have to drink in the morning. I keep a bottle under the bed. I have a drink in the morning just to get in the shower and get dressed and get going, get to work, and I just couldn't wait for lunchtime. You know, every time the phone rang, it was fear. Like, you know, who's going to be on the other end? You know, it's just a job. But there was real fear, and I didn't want to answer that phone. Lunchtime, and I would always keep a couple $100 under the register at the Red Fox because, you know, if funds got low, I wanted to make sure that was covered. That was what was important. And so I'd go drink at lunchtime, come back to the office, sleep it off in an empty office, and then I had a little liquor store. I'd stop that on the way home every day. They had a bottle of Jaeger in the freezer for me to drink on the way home. And it was pretty much daily blackouts, you know, waking up, drinking again, and it was daily insanity. And got to the point where I just couldn't do it anymore, and I decided I was going to stop. And I knew how. I knew how because I'd been to AA before. So I made a really firm resolve, without a solemn oath, to stop drinking. And it didn't go so well. I ended up in a bar. I ended up at Louis B's. And I remember I was drinking, and I just called out to the bar at large, anybody want to play pool? And I got a taker. And I blacked out that night, woke up with that taker in the morning, and stayed with him a year. But while I was with him, I turned 36, and I woke up in the morning, and I said to myself, oh my God, I'm never going to be a mother. I'm 36, and I'm never going to be a mother. So he was in jail at this point, and I wrote him a letter, and I said, you know, let's have a kid. So he writes back and says, yeah, let's do it as soon as I get out of jail. So he came home, you know, I was with child, and then a new bottom hit. See, I had had a wonderful mother, a really, really great mother, and I always wanted to be a mother like her. And when I looked at my life and looked at the things I was doing and the lack of control that I had in every area, I just didn't want to be that kind of mom. And so on Thanksgiving Day, I went home after spending time with the family, and the man I was with had hurt my dog. My dog was bleeding. And I said to myself, if he can do this to my dog, he can do this to my kid. So that's the day I left and came into, all right, I went to Alamo. That was the answer. And I remember hearing people complain about the alcoholic in their lives and talk about all the things that they did that drove me crazy. And I was sitting there getting madder and madder and madder because I did all those things. How dare they talk about those things that I did? They might as well have been talking about me, you know? And December 12th, I had done well, stayed sober for a little over a week, and on December 12th, the night before I got sober, I was at another bar. I was 3 months pregnant. I had a drink in my hand, and I took a drink, and instantly I wanted to go get a bottle. You know, that instant craving, the instant obsession came on, and I was scared. I was really scared because I knew what alcohol can do when you're pregnant. I didn't want to hurt my daughter. And so the very next night, I was able to leave. And the next night I went to the Lion's Den, and that was my first meeting with Alcoholics Anonymous. And I haven't had a drink since. That was over 4.5 years ago. So when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I looked around the room for someone at the Sunday meeting, for a woman who I thought would make a good sponsor. And I found a lady, and her name was Dominique. And she was an amazing, amazing woman. She took me through the steps very quickly. And she was an artist. She's a very successful artist. And she taught me to do my second step by, finding out what symbolizes God to me and then doing some artistic project to symbolize that as a way to understand God a little bit better. And I got a lot out of that. But the main thing that I learned from her was that I had to get honest. I had to admit that I was an alcoholic. And she taught me a lot more than that. You know, I started out by saying that I was the victim. I played the victim role. And something she taught me is that we have to name the things that were done to us so that we don't have to hold on to the victim status anymore. It's okay to say, yes, I was abused. This happened. And then we can move past it. If we keep denying what happens to us, then we just play the victim role in every area. And so she taught me about self-honesty, getting honest, admitting that I'm an alcoholic. Now, obviously, I had a young child at this point, and I had moved in with my parents. They went on vacation for 2 weeks, and I had no idea how to stay sober. I had no idea how to be a mom and stay sober. And I called some women in the program and asked for help. And 7 women came over every day of those 2 weeks, for 2 hours each, and stayed with me and helped me with my child, helped me stay sober. Every one of those women is still sober today, and we all stay in contact. And I changed sponsors around that time, and Lynn became my sponsor. And yeah, I've had 4 sponsors in 4 years, and every one of them has given me incredible gifts. And it was what I needed at the time. You know, and what Lynn taught me was to be of service, to help others, to be humble, put others first. And for any of you that know her, you know, she radiates that in her life with everyone. And she gave me that. Those women who helped me, they did something more than help me with sobriety and my daughter. They made me feel a part of. And when I ask for help and accept that help, that's when I start to feel like I belong. And so whenever I work with someone, I tell them, ask for help, accept it when it's offered. You know, even if you can't do it by yourself, you know, reaching out and accepting help from people in here is how we get close. It's how we get our walls down and get to know each other and support each other. So, I had something else happen in early sobriety that I think happens to some in here. People started talking about the things that I did when I was drinking that they heard from my ex-husband or my ex-so-and-so, and it was really hurtful stuff because they didn't put the positive spin on it that I did. And that's when Erica became my sponsor. I called her up and I told her what was going on, and she says, you know, what they think of you is none of your business. It's just none of your business. And that was hard. That was swallowing pride to say, I don't care what you're saying about me. You know? And the bottom line was, it was true. So what the heck? You know, it's funny, I find that I only really get resentful about things people are saying if it's true. If it's complete downhill. But Erica was with me through probably one of my biggest growing experiences in Alcoholics Anonymous. A lot of us have those family of origin issues, you know, the feelings that come up with a parent. And those seem to be the hardest ones to work through. And I had been at my parents' house that day. Well, actually, I lived at my parents' house at that time. And my dad had said something that brought back all of the feelings from childhood. And instantly, I was 5 years old. And I called Erica, and I said, I don't know what to do about this. We were supposed to be at a barbecue for my nephew, and I was supposed to be there. They went without me. And Erica told me, just put a smile on your face, act as if everything's okay, and go. You know, we'll deal with this later. And I'm 100% sure that would have worked, but that's not what I did. But what I did was really good. What I did is I looked at a picture of him on the wall, and I told him exactly what I thought of that picture. And I cried, and I prayed, and I asked God to help me find my part and to let go of all those feelings. I did a fourth step. I wrote it out, my part and everything that it affected. And I went about an hour and a half late to that barbecue. But by the time I got there, I was able to freely walk up to my dad and say, you know, I'm really sorry for this. This was my part. And once I did that, I wasn't concerned about his part anymore. I didn't need him to change. And so that's a tool that I learned that day that comes in handy. I call it a living fourth step. We call it a tenth step. We call it a fourth step. But that works for me. The sponsor I have now, Suzanne, she took me through, you know, okay, boys, plug your ears. This is just for ladies. You know, part of our fourth step is our sex inventory. And, you know, sex is an instinct that's just as real and powerful as our need for food and you know, self-actualization. I hadn't looked at any of that stuff yet because I thought it was too personal. It didn't matter. I was taught not to talk about those things. When I got with Suzanne, we went through every relationship I'd ever had, and we looked at everything that went wrong and all my part was and my selfishness and my instincts gone awry, and that made a difference. I had done four steps before. But once we did that together and got really honest about that stuff, there was a different kind of freedom, and that was really important for me. So I have a lot of work to do still. You know, I'm 4 years sober. I have not thoroughly worked steps 6, 7, and 9. When I've done them, I've read the paragraph, said a prayer, and moved on. And the sponsor that I have now says, you know, those are action steps. Just because they're a short paragraph in the book doesn't mean we just read the paragraph and move on. And I heard one speaker share about she'd write down her character defect on a 3x5 card, and on the other side she'd write the opposite of that defect. And when that defect came up, she'd flip the card over and do the opposite. And that's how she started to let go of those defects. So I'm doing another fourth step with my sponsor right now, and when we get there, looking forward to working those steps more thoroughly. And I did a lot of my step 9, but to this day I have not made an amends to my father. I've heard in here we make a living amends to our parents. And in the beginning I needed that, because if I had gone to him and tried to make an amends in the beginning, the feelings were so strong I probably would drink. But now I have no excuse. And it's time to take that risk, you know. So these are things that I still get to work on. What time am I done? 6:30. Okay. And the last thing is I'd like to talk about my spiritual journey in AA. I was listening to a speaker the other day, and he said something I really liked, so I'm going to pass it on. He told a joke about, you know, somebody from this religious denomination, somebody else from a different denomination, and then the alcoholic. And they're all in heaven, and they're going to take this interview to see if they can, get into heaven. And the first one comes up, and the question that he asks is, who is God? And he tells them all about everything he knows about God, everything that he's learned in his religion. And he says, great, you know, nice job, you can go through this door. Second one does the same thing. He comes up and tells everything that he's learned about God. Great, you can go through this door. And when the alcoholic got there and they said, who is God? The alcoholic fell to his knees and said, my Lord, my God. Because religions can teach me about God, but in Alcoholics Anonymous, I get to meet God, and I actually meet him in all of you. One other thing I'll steal from somebody else is this man, when he was new, he he went to one of those meetings where they raffle off a big book. And he says, please, God, please let me win this big book. It'll show me you love me. Please, let me win it. And, you know, by the time they got to that point, he was 100% sure that book was his. And when they did the raffle, he didn't get it. Some woman got it. But she gave the book to him. And then when he had more time and he was working with a newcomer, he had forgotten all about that. And he was at another meeting like that, and he says, please, God, let this guy get the book. It'll show me love him. Let him get the book. And he got the book and gave it to him. And his point was, God works through people. And when we isolate ourselves or stay away from meetings, we're isolating ourselves from our higher powers.